Welcome back to the Talon University Podcast. I'm your host, Terry McDonald. I'm a lecturer of international relations here at TLU. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about vaccine diplomacy. Vaccine rollout has been an uneven, politicized process where world powers have been using leverage, pointing fingers, and buying allies with their vaccine supply. To gain a deeper understanding of how this vaccine diplomacy works, today we're fortunate to have with us Dr. Mika Altola. Today's episode is brought to you by Talon University's Bachelor of Arts in Politics and Governance program. The BA in Politics and Governance is a contemporary academic program combining a strong politics and governance core with a variety of choices, including international relations, economics, and management modules. It is a curriculum aimed at preparing students for the more complex and interrelated world of today. No country or company is an island anymore. They're all affected by political, societal, and economic trends, national and international policies, governmental and non-governmental actors. The program equips students with a broad knowledge basis to prepare them for a future not just in government or party politics, but also as knowledgeable and capable actors in international organizations, the third sector, NGOs, or the private sector. I myself am a lecturer in this program and can attest that it is broad-based, it is enjoyable, it is international, and it is all in English. And it is quite affordable. You can find out more at www.tlu.ee/admissions. Dr. Altola is the director of FIA, that's the Finnish Institute of International Affairs, and is a tenured professor of international relations here at TLU. And he's also a docent at Tampere University in Finland. He's been a visiting fellow at Cambridge University, Science Po, and Johns Hopkins, and was a visiting professor at the University of Minnesota. His areas of expertise include U.S. global role, the dynamics of major power politics, democratic vulnerability, and for our purposes today, pandemic security. His latest book, which I encourage you to check out, is Democratic Vulnerability and Autocratic Meddling, The Thucydidian Brink in Regressive Geopolitical Competition. That's from Palgrave Macmillan and was out this year in 2021. So please enjoy our interview with Dr. Altola. Hello, Mika, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, great that you invited me.
So could you tell our listeners what vaccine diplomacy is?
Well, it's basically kind of strategic use of relatively scarce resource for purposes other than what are in accordance with the slogan "One World, One Health." So, what you're trying to achieve is prestige and status, and that's a strategic aim. So, you're using your resources that others want, that you have, and through that you are trying to gain status and try to gain prestige.
Okay, well, different major actors have been engaged in this process. Can you just give us a little overview of what they've been up to? So we'll start with Russia.
Well, Russian situation, of course, you know, their domestic vaccination program hasn't been very smooth so far. About 20% of Russians have been vaccinated. They have multiple different vaccines, but the biggest one and geopolitically perhaps the most used one is Sputnik. Of course, the name itself refers back to the space race, but was also a status game and a prestige game. So superpowers back then, Soviet Union and US, invested quite a lot in the space race, not for the sake of humankind, but there were less altruistic motivations that were about proving and demonstrating who is actually leading the great power rivalry. And similarly, Sputnik is used in that way. It is relatively effective vaccine. It uses kind of a straightforward method using live virus. And it seems that it, as I said, it is relatively effective. But the problem is with any vaccine is that it was tested at a at one particular point in time in one particular location with a very specific mixture of variants of COVID-19. So it doesn't tell us much about how it works in South Africa or how it works in US, because the mixtures of variants are very different there. But it seems to have worked very well in Moscow, in one particular hospital where it was tested, and the rates were over 90% effective in that particular situation, in that particular moment in the mutation history of the vaccine. And this applies to all of the vaccines, that they were tested in different phases with different mixture of variants.
So who has Russia been engaged with when it comes to vaccine diplomacy?
Well, it has been very effective when it comes to Hungary, for example. It has been selling the vaccine relatively cheaper compared to, for example, to China. The Chinese vaccines are much more expensive. And that has geoeconomic implications because, you know, these countries are loaning in order to get the vaccines. For Russia, there's a hurdle to be climbed, but there's a lot of suspicions towards Russia, especially in Europe. And therefore, it is selling it cheaper. So it is more of a prestige issue. It's not like trying to hook you into kind of a loaning against the help type of situation. So Serbia has been using it. Serbia has had a very effective vaccination program. It has been basically using all the vaccines that it can get. The vaccination rate in Serbia is very high. Then Middle East, Persian Gulf countries have been buying Sputnik. And in some countries, there has been this less than scientific method of taking cocktails of vaccines. So different people want to get multiple vaccines because they believe that actually creates better immunity. But we don't know. It hasn't been scientifically proven that it is more effective that way. It could be that one vaccine can also fight against another vaccine because it recognizes the disease footprint in the other vaccine. So it could lead into strong immune response to that particular new vaccine. And that's a problem generally because if we, for example, if the vaccination firewall of a particular vaccine, let's say AstraZeneca, for example, proves to be ineffective, it then leads into a problem what to do next. You know, what boost vaccine might be used in combination with AstraZeneca, for example. So we have been creating now with the vaccines a very extraordinary evolutionary environment for a virus. And nobody knows. This is kind of a once in world history experiment that is going on with the vaccines.
Okay. Well, back to what specific actors are doing vis-a-vis vaccine policy. How about China?
Well, China has been very clearly geo-economic in its approach. So vaccine diplomacy is mainly for the countries that already are part of the Belt and Road projects. So those countries have been given this vaccine, and in many cases it is against loans from China. So China has, in some countries in Africa, pretty much a monopoly over the vaccination programs, and that is part of kind of the overall logic of how the Belt and the Road mechanism works. So it gets these countries deeper into the program, integrated, multifaceted program. Besides infrastructure, now you have vaccines. And it also tells to the citizens, and this is part of the vaccine diplomacy, it tells to the citizens of a particular country who is actually able to take care of their health. So it comes to your skin. It is a very kind of a personal relationship when you get a vaccine from a particular country. Sorry about the dogs. My wife is coming home. So the idea is that it is a personal relationship. So it's not about giving, for example, military aid or building a harbor. It is giving something straight to citizens of a particular country. So it can be compared to food aid in that respect, that it kind of fulfills a basic need. And if you
similar to the old USAID giving away food with the American flag on it,
the North Korea case, how large size is the American flag in the food shacks that are given to the North Koreans. The North Koreans demanded that they are given without any sacks and without any emblems, national emblems. And there's a reason for that, because it creates this kind of a special relationship. You know who is helping you. And vaccines is similar to that. And before vaccines, of course, a year ago, we had this personal protective equipment diplomacy where China and Russia were shipping masks and other hospital gear to particular places like Spain and Italy. And most of Europe were very dependent on China on producing the masks before they could gear up the national or the European production of PPEs. This is a kind of a gold mine of influencing the pandemic, paradoxically so.
Okay. Well, I know India has been a special case. They have been engaged in vaccine diplomacy, but obviously they're pulling back right now. How about the USA?
Well, USA has been, since the Trump administration launched the vaccination program, that then was jump-started by President Biden. It has been that vaccinate your own citizens first and then give vaccines to others. But at the same time, we have to remember that vaccines are not produced by countries anywhere in the world. They are done by multinational corporations, and most of them are Americans. So for example, when I got my vaccine last week, I got an American-made vaccine. That was produced in Europe. So it is a complicated situation. It is very natural for common citizens to kind of think about in terms of nation states, but it is actually complicated interdependent process where vaccines are produced. So they are done out of 20 to 100 different components, and those components are produced in about 13 nations. Okay. And they are very interdependent. So European Union is one of the largest vaccine producers in the world, but the US is of course very very large as well. And compared to European Union, what makes US perhaps different is that because of the Cold War laws, they can fund directly for vaccination production, so they can fund the companies that do the production. Whereas the European Union even has regulations against this type of direct funding of particular companies.
Okay.
So there's a clear kind of a paradigm difference there. So that gave US they were able to quicker vaccinate people, but they are now running into the ceiling. That there is a particular proportion of the population that don't want to be vaccinated. So, and that this varies in different countries.
Well, another issue,
In the US, it seems that about 30% of the population doesn't want to be vaccinated. And that creates a problem, because the question is, are they going to achieve herd immunity in the US or not? And if they don't achieve that, then the disease is going to remain in circulation but new variants are going to develop in the US. In Europe, I think the skepticism is a little bit lower, but a significant proportion in different countries are not going to take the vaccine. and that creates a problem. But for US vaccine diplomacy, it could be also positive because they can now start shipping, and they have started shipping to Canada and to Mexico, relatively small amounts of vaccines, but still they are doing that, and they promised a couple of weeks ago, they promised that they are going to produce about 1,000 million vaccine doses for the rest of the world in before the end of the year. Okay. And it is doable. They can do that. And now when they decided that they are going to support the removal of the patent rights in WTO, that of course changed the game dramatically, because US usually hasn't been supporting anything like that. But now the Biden administration is doing that. And that of course is part of the vaccine diplomacy. They are so showing goodwill. So, you know, the negative press on US is shifting towards positive press. And now it is Germany and France who are against that in the World Trade Organization.
Well, yeah, well, we're just going to get to that. How about Europe's vaccine diplomacy?
Well, this is different. You know, usually we are used to that humanitarian catastrophes and natural disasters. They happen elsewhere in the world. And what COVID-19 did when the first line of defense failed in Wuhan, spectacularly failed in Wuhan in late December, early January last year, then everything was lost, and Europe actually didn't have that much in place in order to have a kind of a second line of defense. What happened was that the effort was nationalized. So in isolation, all the European member states had their own policies without much coordination. Now the coordination level has gone up. Europe is producing vaccines. As I said, that it is one of the largest vaccine producing places in the world. For example, AstraZeneca is a good example of that. Vaccine developed by Oxford University, okay, meant for global markets. So it is basically a humanitarian vaccine. So 60% of that particular vaccine is supposed to be very cheaply distributed globally. So it was kind of a humanitarian sentiment behind it. But of course, vaccine nationalism, which is of course part of this vaccine diplomacy, vaccine nationalism in Europe gained quite a lot of stamina. And they raided the AstraZeneca global shipping factory in Italy and claimed that there's something sinister going on. But on the paper, Europe has been exporting the most vaccines in the world, but it's not because of European general goodwill. Mostly it is because of the production facilities happen to be in Europe and they are shipping those vaccines outside of Europe. But it has caused quite a lot of political sensitivities in different European Union member states. But Europe has been contributing to the global effort as well, not only this kind of an indirect, involuntary shipments of vaccines made in Europe to different places, but also contributing financially to the World Health Organization's global vaccination effort. So, but as I said, this was an unusual situation. Okay. After Wuhan, it hit kind of the most developed part of the world, kind of the first world. So the misery, the epicenters were first in Europe and then in US. Now the epicenter is in India and in Brazil. So still the caseloads are climbing very rapidly in different parts of the world. Luckily, the kind of the global effort is now winning. In the sense that it is better funded than it was last spring. It was very, very underfunded, and now pledges are coming in, and so the vaccine diplomacy that prevailed during the last year is now chasing into much more coordinated effort.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that, but I want to get to a point you made. It seemed like the more authoritarian governments got off to a faster start with vaccine diplomacy. Why is that?
Well, for us, it is motivated by the status game. For China, the simple reason is that it suffocated the disease effectively. So actually, you know, when you don't have disease, then you have vaccines that you can ship elsewhere. So there are different kind of motivations and different conditions underneath there. For Russia, it was an effort to show that Russia still is meaningful when it comes to innovating new types of technologies like vaccines. For China, it was that, you know, we defeated the disease domestically, and now we are contributing to the effort with our partners, Belt and Road partners, to help them. So there are different reasons behind the national approaches. For Israel, for example, that was very effective in gaining vaccines. It had to do with the very fact that in Israel it was a national security issue from the very beginning. So it mobilized the whole security apparatus of the state, even the intelligence agencies, in order to vacuum as many vaccines as it could in a short period of time. It was a national survival game. Taiwan is similar type of case. You know, it was clearly motivated out of national security more so than in many other places where it was kind of a part of the domestic security, societal security game. In some cases, it was also part of the welfare, like in Nordic countries. It was part of the welfare. You know, you needed to get vaccines in order to prove that your system, welfare system, is working, and countries were motivated because of that. An interesting part of the Russia case that I forgot to mention is that there's also a kind of a goodwill. So it's not only the kind of the supply that is available in Russia, it is also the goodwill that some countries want to demonstrate towards Russia, that they feel that the Russian vaccine is acceptable and they acknowledge its effectiveness, and they are willing to signal to Russia that they would take the vaccine if that would be possible. Some European states have been doing that. They know that they are not going to start importing or producing Sputnik, but they are signaling to Russia that you are okay country, we can deal with you.
So do you think this is part of Hungary's motivation?
Well, Hungary has close relations with Russia and China. It was willing to take, without the approval of the European Union authorities, willing to take these vaccines in order to show also this kind of a trust towards these countries. So it's not kind of a one-way street. It is now becoming a two-way street because there's more vaccines available. And in some cases, it's kind of an ineffectiveness of the national vaccine programs more so than availability of the vaccines. That is the problem.
So do you think that this authoritarian push and authoritarian cooperation has implications, like wider implications for the world?
Well, to a degree, yes. Clearly, they demonstrated that they have this. Besides the standardized Western medical industry, that there's alternative sources. But of course, mostly in Europe and mostly in North America, the vaccines are going to come from very traditional manufacturers. So I don't know how effective China and Russia have been in the overall game when it comes to status and prestige. But at least they haven't failed in that. And that's, I think, kind of one of the basic lessons that have been learned.
Well, I guess besides the initial failure of it getting out in the first place.
Yeah, well, that was a big failure, and you know, the kind of the approval numbers of China have dramatically declined over the year in many places globally, according to opinion polls. So they have a mountain to climb, and you know, so the vaccine diplomacy, how successful it has been, I don't know. I think it has been successful in the sense that China managed to suffocate the disease, and then it managed to develop a vaccine to do something in different other places. So it can then dent the negative feelings to a degree and accentuate the positives. But for China, there's not much positives in this. For Russia, there's a little bit more positives. Although when you go to Czech Republic, for example, you know, they have had domestic problems and political scandals over the Sputnik vaccination. One of the problems with the Sputnik vaccination is that the quality of the production is not very consistent in Russia. And that might be one of the reasons why European Union member states like Germany has been negotiating with Russians so that the vaccine could be produced in Germany. Finland has done the same, kind of offered to buy the know-how and facilitate the process in order to make the production a little bit better, because there has been a little bit low-grade vaccines exported from Russia. And the problem of black market is also something that needs to be seen in many, many African countries. They are basically selling water, saline, and saying that it is vaccine. So you can go to the internet sites and buy vaccines, but they are not vaccines. So there's a huge black market of vaccines that is happening. And you don't know what you are kind of ending up using.
That's terrible.
But at least there's a placebo effect. So, but that can be in this situation be very harmful, because then you go around and about and you don't protect your health because you feel that you have been immunized even though you haven't.
Well, you talked about the struggles that USA and Europe have been having when it comes to reaching out. What has stopped them from being more engaged in vaccine diplomacy or getting a late start at least?
Well, it is in democracies. And generally, when we are talking about kind of the compassion, it is a kind of a mid-range feeling at the most. You know, our altruism, especially when we are dealing with pandemic diseases, is very limited. So nearest is the dearest, is the name of the game.
Okay.
So and political accountability in democracy is kind of required that the citizens in the republics are first vaccinated. So that seems to have been one of the factors. So you have to take care of your own population. And the European Union plan has been that when there is extra vaccines available, then the close by, kind of the neighborhood, gets the surplus. So we are talking about countries like Ukraine, Sahel region, North Africa, kind of the neighborhood, because of the need to kind of stabilize those regions. And there you can see kind of a component of the kind of the EU vaccine diplomacy, that it is geared towards those countries that are seen as the most vital for the stability of the region. But as you said, European Union is to a degree later arrival to the strategic use of vaccines, but unintendedly they have been shipping the most and exporting the most vaccines in the world.
Well, you raised the issue of patent protection and IP protection when it comes to this. Can you just give a quick explainer to anyone who doesn't know what's going on with the Biden administration being willing to waive it, but European hesitancy?
Well, the Biden administration has been saying that it can waive WTO, there's a special regulation that allows this to happen. This is kind of a remnant of the HIV/AIDS times and the IP being very vital for some countries like Brazil and North and South Africa, for example. So there's regulations that states that the intellectual property rights can be waived, but it has to be compensated to the companies. So you know, it doesn't happen without a compensation. So what it actually means is that the vaccine manufacturers are going to get their money. But what the vaccine manufacturers are worrying about is that, or claiming to worry about, is that then the innovation kind of disappears. So the business model is then so different that they don't feel the urgency to develop new types of vaccines against possible new variants of the disease. So they say that they were very historically quick in reacting to this, that the system worked as it was supposed to. So why tinker with the system? And the Germans are worried about that as well. So the European Union approach was kind of a market-based approach. So the resilience is the global production and value chains. And if you tinker with those, it can then cause a situation where there's no supply against new variants because there's no incentive for the multinational corporations to produce these vaccines. So the American line is a little bit unusually un-American in here, and it could be kind of a diplomatic. They know that the rules are not going to change radically and fast enough. And the production of vaccines is rapidly increasing. So actually the need for wavering the intellectual property rights is not that urgent, but they are demonstrating and signaling that they're willing to do it because this is a global emergency and the Biden administration wants to kind of also demonstrate that it stands by the one world, one health type of approach. And to a degree, they are right because, you know, nobody is safe until everybody is safe in pandemic situations. If there's evolutionary places where the disease can develop variants, then of course, the virus is clever enough to do it.
Okay. Well, speaking of the WTO, what role have the major international organizations played in all of this thus far?
Well, of course, you can criticize the World Health Organization. It failed in its basic mission, but I have to say that we have to be fair to them because, you know, they cover so much scope when it comes to health, from chronic diseases to prevention, and then they have this pandemic security that is basically what the world expected them to do. The international health regulations that were enacted 2005 after SARS pandemic, the lessons learned, gave them some tools and weapons, but in case that a member state like China doesn't notify in time, then they don't have much that they can do. They cannot ship, they cannot kind of fly in some disease cowboys who will take care of the outbreak zone and clear things. It doesn't happen like in science fiction movies. So they have some blame, but we have to be fair to them. And then ICAO, United Nations organization that is in charge of the air traffic, the avia police, the global avia police. Of course, the cooperation between World Health Organization and ICAO should be seamless because the vector of this disease was air travel. And it arrived to all the other countries except from China by flying. So you know, but we haven't checked this still, even though we have experienced multiple scares, pandemic scares, like SARS and MERS and avian flu and swine flu and and multiple other scales, like the actual wide scale epidemic in Western Africa of Ebola. Yeah. We still are kind of we have less than integrated system of responding to this. And I hope that these new initiatives that are flying around can make the system a little bit better. You know, this pain of COVID-19 has been great enough, I hope, to produce at least agenda setting mode when it comes to actually creating something global when it comes to pandemic security. But this has failed before. And I suppose it's going to fail in the future as well. So let's see how successful are countries that are trying to achieve a reform of the World Health Organization and the reform of the International Health Protocol.
So do you think this is going to lead to an enhanced role for international organizations in international affairs?
Well, it seems
that... Or is it going to be like multipolar, like the response has been?
Yeah, it could be... But it's kind of a club place, the world. So some countries are going to require quite a lot of certificates and new regulations in order for travelers to enter into these countries. So it's going to be a patchwork for a while at least. Well, let's see what type of vaccination passports we need and other types of documents and which countries are going to require these. Some countries are requiring their own vaccines, like China is requiring that you take the Chinese version of the vaccine in order to come to China. So it's going to be a patchwork. And the international governance is under strain. So let's think that the world is still going to be for a long time on knife's edge on this. Let's not fall into the fallacy of thinking that somehow this is going to create a great reform, because the basic problem is the kind of the nation state global governance cleavage. So China didn't notify in time again. You know, SARS they failed, now in COVID-19 they failed. So actually the notification to the headquarters of World Health Organization was sent by the country office of a World Health Organization in China, not by Chinese authorities. Mm. So they weren't very forthcoming when it came to kind of revealing the true nature of the disease, you know, like the human-to-human contagion or infection possibility. They weren't producing the information quickly enough. And countries, you know, besides the vaccine nationalism, vaccine diplomacy, we have also kind of this secrecy, disease secrecy, that is a prevailing, the resistant feature of being an Asian state, that they are too proud to announce that they might be that outbreaks might be happening in their country. So this is a kind of a historically long-standing tradition that countries tend to hide these things.
Yeah, I guess authoritarian countries especially.
Yes.
So, I'll let you go on one last question here. So what has vaccine rollout taught us about international relations?
Well, it is an X-ray of international relations, and things like this happen usually when the governance is weakening and kind of the political space is less ordered. And we have seen that over the past 20 years that the political space is getting weaker, more vulnerable, less organized, at least globally speaking. The global governance has been under enormous strain. Great power rivalry has emerged again, and there's quite a lot of alternative motivations that different nations have in international cooperation. So it has revealed an X-ray of what can happen when the political space and the governance gets weaker. Two things can happen, you know, laws of the jungle emerge suddenly. I mean, you know, kind of a conflicts and different forms of crisis that happen between political communities. And then, you know, kind of those white or black swans can happen. Accidents, you know, like pandemic outbreaks can happen. If this would have happened 10 years ago, I think we would have been more prepared and more effective in the response, you know, similar to what the Obama administration did in Africa in 2014, 2015 with the Ebola outbreak, actually reacting, going there fast, not trying to bunker down and close borders, but actually dealing with the situation. That's the way the governance is supposed to work. You have to face the situation as it is. Now we just like try to cover up and buffer ourselves from the outbreak. But at the end, it will reach all the corners of the world. There's nothing that can stop it.
Okay. Well, Mika, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Hopefully, we'll have you on again soon.
All right. So, bye bye.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Masters of Screen Media and Innovation here at Talon University. How relevant are screens in your life? Do you, like an average American, spend 12 hours a day in front of your screen? I know during pandemic times, I've averaged at least 12 hours a day, I'm sure. Screen media is a crucial source of information, interaction, and basically it is the medium of our modern society. So come study screen media and innovation here at the Baltic Film Media and Arts School. It's all in English. It's a very internationalized program and competitive tuition prices. You can find out more at www.tlu.ee/admissions. Okay, thank you for joining us again on the Talon University podcast. I want to give a big thanks to Mika for joining us, and thanks to Fia, who have always been a wonderful partner of us here at TLU. I'd like to give a shout out to our sponsors, the Talon University School of Governance, Law, and Society, and of course the Baltic Film, Media, and Arts School, where we record. Our producer has been Avo Ulvik, research by Vega Semole, Rahatni Palage, Sadat Awadu, Maurice Odo, and Ilya Shore. The theme song is by myself and Paul Simon. All other music is by Avo Ulvik or by myself. Find us on social media, Twitter at Talon Podcast, and Facebook and Instagram at TLU Podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, please make sure to subscribe, give us rating, 5 stars, 5 stars. Thank you very much, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks.